was recorded by Don Hill, departing for Camp Shelby, Mississippi, from Central Station.
The north side of the Jefferson County Armory in downtown Louisville. This morning, the 138th Field Artillery Regiment of Louisville departs for Camp Shelby, Mississippi, for a year's military training. And we're here at the Jefferson County Armory to bring you a word's eye view of the proceedings as these 650 men prepare to depart for Camp Shelby. First, a bit of a word of explanation. There was an advanced detail of this 138th Field Artillery Regiment, which went down to Camp Shelby on the 23rd of this month. But this is the main bulk and body of the regiment, and it consists of about 650 men. It's divided into two groups, because half of these 650 men are going to make the trip to Camp Shelby, Mississippi by train, and the other half are going to drive in a motor convoy. Here at a little bit after 6:30, the troops who are going to march to the railroad station to depart by train are just about ready to leave the back door of the Jefferson County Armory to march down the streets of Louisville to the railroad station at 7th and River to make their departure by train. Their train departs at 7 o'clock. Also at 7 o'clock, the motor convoy consisting of 134 vehicles will depart from the riding hall. And we are going to drive along in our mobile unit, giving you a picture of the troops as they march down the street to the station, then wheel around and try to return to the riding hall in time to pick up the start of the departure of the half of the troops which are going by motor convoy. And now I can see down there ahead of us a few feet the first group of troops marching along 6th Street heading north, and others still inside the armory. As we go by the open door, we can see in the armory and see the troops all lined up in there with the various captains and colonels at their heads. And we're going to try to swing in behind the band of the 138th, if we possibly can, and to give you a picture of the troops as they march down the street. The advance guard, which apparently is the kitchen detail, because they have lots of boxes of food under their arm, marching along on 6th Street heading to the north. And from back behind, I can hear whistles. And now we're going to have to pull out into 6th Street here and wait until the band comes along. We're going to swing in behind the band. And then the other 325 or so men who are in this particular detail marching to the station to go along on the train will be along very shortly. Now we can hear the band in the background, and they'll be swinging around us pretty soon, and we'll try to pick up some of the music. They're playing My Old Kentucky Home, and here is the band of the Louisville 138th Field Artillery Regiment. Ladies and gentlemen, we're back inside our mobile unit. The band of the 138th Field Artillery Regiment is marching across Liberty Street on 6th, heading north. And immediately behind us comes the first of the groups of marching men en route from the Jefferson County Armory to the railroad station at 7th and River to depart on the 7 o'clock train. And as we told you, at 7 o'clock, the motor portion will leave from the riding hall in their motor convoy. At the head of the troops marching to the train is the band headed by Mr. Lynn Thayer. And following the band immediately behind our mobile unit comes the Regimental Headquarters Battalion, a group of marching National Guardsmen in long columns of three each. And this Regimental Headquarters Battalion is under the direction of Captain Howard Norman. Behind the Regimental Headquarters Battalion, which is a battalion always preceding any group of marching men, comes the battalion known as the 1st Battalion of the 138th Field Artillery. And this 1st Battalion is under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Claude Watkins. And Lieutenant Colonel Watkins is preceding his men, and included in the 1st Battalion are the 1st Battalion Headquarters Battery under Captain Clarence Jones. In other words, each of the particular battalions is made up of a headquarters battery and three firing batteries. So we can see the entire 1st Battalion marching behind us, and at the head of the 1st Battalion, the 1st Headquarters Battery under Captain Clarence Jones. Now, this size battery usually contains 57 men, these headquarters batteries, but as we told you, half of them are going by motor convoy. Immediately following the 1st Battalion Headquarters Battery are the three firing batteries of the 1st Battalion. And these three firing batteries are known as A, B, and C. And these firing batteries, A, B, and C, usually contain 27 men, but contain now about 35 to 40, since half of each particular firing battery is going by motor. And behind us, we can see the entire 1st Battalion, including the Regimental Headquarters Battalion, then the 1st Battalion, which does include the Headquarters Battery and the three firing batteries. And they're broken up into groups, in other words, marching by batteries as we proceed north on 6th Street, and now are approaching Jefferson Street, just a few feet ahead of us. And again, the band is playing out in front of us with Lynn Thayer directing, and Colonel George M. Cheshire, who is in charge of the entire 138th Field Artillery Regiment, marching at the front of the entire column of men. Behind the 1st Battalion, which we were speaking of a few seconds ago, is the 2nd Battalion. And just like the first one, the 2nd Battalion contains, first of all, in addition to its three firing batteries, the headquarters battery. So each battalion really contains four batteries. First, the headquarters battery, and then three firing batteries. And now we're swinging over onto Market Street and proceeding west on Market Street, going down to 7th. We've been coming along north on 6th Street. There's a streetcar going by, adding a little sound effects. Now we're proceeding west here on Market Street to 7th, and then we'll make another turn to the right and go down 7th Street to the railroad station at 7th and River. And making the turn far behind us now, we can see the 2nd Battalion. However, we would like to give you the names of some of the gentlemen who are in charge of the various batteries in Battalion A. We told you that the entire 1st Battalion is under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Claude Watkins, and Captain Clarence Jones is in charge of the 1st Battalion Headquarters Battery. The three firing batteries in Battalion A are, respectively, Firing Battery A under Captain Gene Lindsay, Firing Battery B is under Captain Walter Calvert, and Firing Battery C is under Captain Philip Ross. Then comes the 2nd Battalion, making the turn back there now on 6th Street, similar to the 1st, and the entire 2nd Battalion is under the command of Lieutenant Colonel S.C. Bolt. It contains the 2nd Battalion Headquarters Battery, headed by Captain Elmer Carroll, and immediately followed by the three firing batteries of the 2nd Battalion, these known as D, E, and F. Firing Battery D is under Captain Ed Gregg, and Mr. Gregg is just making the turn now back there behind us about a block. In the meantime, our mobile unit is swinging around onto 7th Street, heading north once again. Firing Battery E is under Captain C.J. Cronin, Jr., and that unit now is making the turn. And following is Firing Battery E under Captain C.D. Wilson. And following the entire 2nd Battalion, including its headquarters battery and three firing batteries, is the medical detachment of the 138th Field Artillery Regiment. The trained troops, by the way, this particular group of trained troops marching down the streets of Louisville at this early hour, are due to arrive in Camp Shelby at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. However, the motor convoy won't get there for a couple of days. The band is still right ahead of our mobile unit, and the marching troops, one half of the 138th Field Artillery Regiment, behind us. We can see the Central Station sign now, just about 100 yards ahead north on 7th Street. I see the band isn't playing any music right for the moment, just the drummers keeping the boys in step. And looking back through the back window of our mobile unit, we can still see the Regimental Headquarters Battery. Behind them, all of Battalion 1, including the Headquarters Battery and the three firing batteries. And now just beginning to make the turn on 7th Street, where we were a few seconds ago, is Battalion number 2. And that 2nd Battalion contains both a Headquarters Battery and three firing groups also. The motor convoy plans to depart at 7 o'clock. We're going to try to get back down there and trying to bring you the start of that departure, and it's under the direction of Lieutenant Colonel J.F. Hardy, who is Regimental Executive Officer. Now some more music by the band. ladies and gentlemen, we have stopped our mobile unit because we have reached the circle here at 7th and River Station, and the band is already marching in underneath the train shed, ready to go on board to make their 7 o'clock departure. We want to tell you that these 650 men comprise the 138th Field Artillery Regiment of the city of Louisville, and now the commanders give the command halt, and the troops all line up way down 7th Street, come to a halt. You can hear the clanging train bells in the background. This is the National Guard unit, and this group is en route to Camp Shelby, Mississippi, for a year's military training as Louisville joins the nation in her defense and preparation for national defense. Well, we're swinging over here in front, and the troops go on marching by. You can hear the commands of the officers. We're going to stick our microphone up here now and pick up some of the commands. And the command at rest has now been given, and the troops take it easy for a moment as they line up here right in front of the train shed at 7th and River. The band is already underneath the train shed, and quite a crowd of people's gathered down here to witness the departure of the 138th Field Artillery for Camp Shelby. The color guard at the front of this particular group, and right now, as we speak to you from the station here at 7th and River, we are standing right alongside the Regimental Headquarters Battalion under Captain Howard Norman. Behind this Regimental Headquarters Battalion are the two battalions known as the 1st and 2nd Battalions, each divided into four batteries, a headquarters battery and three firing batteries, which we have attempted to describe for you as they came marching down the streets in long columns, three wide, forward to the 7th Street station here. The troops are at rest, and I see a few wives and sweethearts coming up for that goodbye kiss right now, and some mothers and fathers, too, mingling in with the troops and wishing everybody their goodbye. Now, here is Colonel George M. Cheshire. We're going to get him on the air for a few words. Colonel Cheshire?
Well, the battalions are moving on the train right now. We've halted here just for a few minutes. They're letting one train get out until we entrain. The motor movement will leave promptly at 7 and go by route out 7th Street. Goodbye, all.
Well, thank you very much, Colonel Cheshire. A few words from Colonel George M. Cheshire, who is in command of the entire 138th Field Artillery Regiment, which has now assembled here at 7th Street Station and is about ready to depart. We're going to endeavor to turn our mobile unit around and head back south on 7th Street just as soon as we're able now in order to get back down to the riding hall on Liberty to attempt to pick up the departure of the motor convoy. But it looks like we're not going to be able to get out of here for just a few moments because the entire two battalions are strung out behind us on 7th Street. And as Colonel Cheshire told you, the reason for the delay is due to the fact that there was another train in ahead of the troop train which must get out first, and it's going to be a little bit of time here before that first train departs, and the troops are going to be held up accordingly. Rather chilly this morning down here before dawn, 7th Street Station, as these National Guardsmen prepare for their train journey southward. Well, we're going to endeavor now to drive our mobile unit through the ranks of the soldiers. I don't know what success we're going to have because the entire two battalions, instead of staying in their columns now, after having been given the command at rest, have sort of spread out all over 7th Street and around the circle here waiting for the first train to depart so that the troop train itself can be pulled onto the track right up here at the train shed. And now I believe we're going to be given some assistance by some of the commanders, to some of the captains, as we endeavor to back our mobile unit around here at the 7th Street Station. I see over there in the crowd lots of mothers and fathers coming in, shaking hands and throwing their arms around their boys' necks, and some of the sweethearts coming in and getting a very public goodbye kiss, which nobody seems to mind at all. And now we're swinging our mobile unit around back into a parking place. We're going to try to break through and head back south on 7th Street from which we came just a few moments ago and get back down to the riding hall to pick up the departure of the other half of the 138th Field Artillery Regiment of the National Guard. This half, assembled here at the 7th Street Station, is going by train, and as we explained at the start of our broadcast a few moments ago, the other half is driving south in a motor convoy, and we want to get down there to pick up the departure of those vehicles, which will be in just a few moments. Both the train troops here and the motor convoy down there are scheduled to depart at exactly 7 o'clock, which will be in a little bit less than 15 minutes from now. And now some of the captains are kindly obliging by keeping some of the crowd back. We're going to try to drive right through this group of troops here and get back south on 7th Street Some of the soldier boys very close to our fenders as we go by. They're all at rest, taking it easy, waiting for the train, which is in there on the tracks ahead, to get out of the way. And then their train will be pulled up underneath the train shed so that the troops can climb aboard and make the long journey south. These boys have just about a 25-hour journey ahead of them on the train, while the motor convoy is going to take a little bit longer to make the trip south. Now we are through the entire column of troops, the 2nd Battalion and the military detachment all there, and just a long line of automobiles here on 7th Street, and we're trying to get back to the south. I want to tell you just a little bit about the motor convoy. It contains 134 vehicles under Lieutenant Colonel J.E. Hardy, the regimental executive officer, and includes the battalion and regimental reconnaissance cars for the most part. A few station wagons will be in the parade, too, and these station wagons are used for command and reconnaissance work. There will also be a few prime movers, and that's the name given the vehicles which pull the field pieces. And the route of the motor convoy will be south on 31W to Columbia, Tennessee tonight, where they will sleep tonight. Tomorrow morning, they'll be up bright and early again and head on south to Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And on the second night, tomorrow night, they'll stay in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Then, the third morning, they will again assemble and motor on to Camp Shelby, arriving there on the 29th, that's Wednesday, Camp Shelby being located 10 miles south of Hattiesburg, Mississippi. I see that an automobile now is blocking our progress here as we reach the corner of 7th and Main, and several police officers back there trying to keep the automobiles from going down the stretch of 7th Street to the station, because there's already a long line of cars down there, and with the 350 or so men in the group, it's rather congested down there, what with all the fathers, mothers, sweethearts, and friends and relatives of the troops. And now a police officer is going to let us by here. And now we're heading back into the open field, so to speak, on 7th Street, heading south again, going to get back down to the riding hall. And as soon as we reach the riding hall, we'll pick up the departure of the motor convoy. I think if we end up at the corner of 7th and Liberty, that we will probably be as close as we can get to the start of the motor convoy. We were told that the most economical and practical speed for this long column of motor vehicles to maintain is between 23 and 26 miles an hour. They can make better time by rolling at that speed than at any other. A streetcar swings around in front of us, and we're going to go on around it and head south here on 7th Street until we get back down to Liberty. We've just been down to the 7th and River Station witnessing the marching of the troops, the train portion of the 138th, who will leave on the 7 o'clock train. And there was nothing more to do down there in view of the fact that the soldiers were put at rest, meaning they could take it easy until such time as their train was actually made ready. Now we're back down here another block and just about to go on across Market Street and get on down to Liberty to the riding hall, where Colonel Hardy's motor convoy is assembled and is just about ready to depart. Moving along now, going across Jefferson Street, heading south in our mobile unit. Beginning to get just a little bit lighter. When we began this broadcast 30 minutes ago or so, it was very dark, and the troops made their marching movement en route to the station in almost total darkness. Now I see a motorcycle policeman down there trying to clear the traffic for us, and also straighten out and unblock the traffic, unsnarl it, and give a clear view and the clear streets to the vehicles of the motor convoy. Now we want to swing our mobile unit over here because I see this is the point of departure, and there is Colonel Hardy, and we're going to jump out of our mobile unit once again and interview Colonel Hardy for just a few words and try to pick up the sound of the trucks as the motor convoy prepares to make its departure here from the corner of 7th and Liberty. And here is Lieutenant Colonel J.E. Hardy, Regimental Executive Officer in charge of the motor convoy.
All right, serials report.
Lieutenant,
first serial.
Lieutenant Cotton, Brigade Headquarters reporting. First serial in order, sir.
Second serial, Captain Bruce Vance, 1st Battalion, 138th Field Artillery.
First serial in order, sir.
Third serial, Captain Waters, commanding 2nd Battalion.
Third serial in order, sir.
All right. Start motors.
And there you've had the official commands of Lieutenant Colonel J.E. Hardy getting his checks from his officers, and they've all reported everything in order and ready to go, and you heard him give the command, start motors. We're going to go out here and try to pick up the actual sound of the start of the first motor, which will signify the departure of the motor portion of the convoy to Camp Shelby of the 138th Field Artillery Regiment. The respective commanders who gave those reports to Captain Hardy a few seconds ago have gone back now way down the long lines here of 134 motor vehicles. Meantime, they're waiting for one streetcar to get out of the way, and I expect we'll have the motors of these first two trucks heading the two long columns, one on either side of the street, started very shortly. I see the vehicles are all loaded. Soldiers are in them and a few of them out on the street. Police keeping the traffic clear in front so that the two columns can pull out now at almost any moment. And now the motor vehicles are beginning to start their motors, and it won't be very long until they start pulling out and heading south on 31W, heading eventually for Camp Shelby. Now on down the line, we can see other motors being started, and in just a few seconds, this particular group will be pulling out. So, ladies and gentlemen, we conclude our broadcast, which has originated in several points in downtown Louisville, beginning at the Jefferson County Armory, down to the 7th Street Station, and back here to the corner of 7th and Liberty, where the motor vehicles have started their motors now and are beginning to pull out and make the long journey over to 31W and then south as Louisville joins with the nation in preparation for national defense. And this is Don Hill speaking and returning you now to our studios in the Brown Hotel.
Every journey begins with a single step. For over 38 million Americans, that means traveling with the Discover Card.
PB Max, real peanut butter snacks. We mean peanut butter.
The tall man with the high hat and the whiskers on his chin will soon be knocking at your door, and you ought to be in. The tall man with the high hat will be coming down your way. Get your savings out when you hear him shout, any bonds today.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin.
The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
President, escorted by his son James, Captain Jimmy Roosevelt, in the uniform of the United States Marine Corps, followed by his military aide, Major General Edwin M. Watson, and his naval aide, Captain John R. Beardall. The other members of the Secretariat are also come in with him. Stephen Early, we see. Now the President has taken his position at the clerk's desk, and in a few moments he will be introduced to this historic joint session of Congress.
And representatives, I have the distinguished honor of presenting the President of the United States.
Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Indeed, 1 hour after Japanese air squadrons had commenced bombing in the American island of Oahu, the Japanese ambassador to the United States and his colleague delivered to our Secretary of State a formal reply to a recent American message. And while this reply stated that it seemed useless to continue the existing diplomatic negotiations, it contained no threat or hint of war or of armed attack. It will be recorded that the distance of Hawaii from Japan makes it obvious that the attack was deliberately planned many days or even weeks ago. During the intervening time, the Japanese government has deliberately sought to deceive the United States by false statements and expressions of hope for continued peace. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. Yesterday, the Japanese government also launched an attack against Malaya. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Hong Kong. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Guam. Last night, Japanese forces attacked the Philippine Islands. Last night, the Japanese attacked Wake Island. And this morning, the Japanese attacked Midway Island. Japan has therefore undertaken a surprise offensive extending throughout the Pacific area. The facts of yesterday and today speak for themselves. The people of the United States have already formed their opinions and well understand the implications to the very life and safety of our nation. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense. But always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. I believe that I interpret the will of the Congress and of the people when I assert that we will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us. Hostilities exist. There is no blinking at the fact that our people, our territory, and our interests are in grave danger. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph. So help us God. I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
Ladies and gentlemen, the national anthem.
And now, back to the capital of the United States.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States has asked the Congress to declare a state of war, that a state of war exists between the United States and Japan. He has retired from the chamber of the House of Representatives, from which point he has spoken, to the joint session of the Congress. The Speaker has declared the joint session dissolved. The members of the President's cabinet have retired. They were followed immediately by the members of the Supreme Court, and now the Senate. They're leaving the House chamber. The applause you hear in the background comes from the members of the House who cheer their colleagues from the other side of the Capitol building. 96 senators, presumably most of them here because, well, it would appear that they are, slowly filing out the center aisle. The north door of the House chamber, down the long corridor to the Senate chamber. The Speaker of the House conferring for a moment with his parliamentarian, Louis Deschler. And we'll stay with the action here on the House floor for a few moments in order that we may bring you the introduction of the resolution by the Honorable John W. McCormick of Massachusetts,
Majority Leader of the House of Representatives, whom we've been told will present the resolution for the House of Representatives, recognizing that a state of war does exist between the United States and the Empire of Japan, and carrying out the request of the President, as stated in his brief message today. The last few members of the Senate just now leaving the House chamber. Ladies and gentlemen, in a few moments, the House of Representatives will go back in session, but we have been asked by the Speaker of the House to discontinue broadcasting from the House floor. For a moment, we will switch you over to the Senate side. If Balkage is standing by there, we might have just a word from him, if he's there. Mr. Balkage, have you a word from the Senate?
From the Senate Radio Gallery, this is Don Gardner speaking to you. And now we turn the microphone over to Balkage, our noted NBC commentator, with a few observations on the facts of the day. Balkage.
Balkage talking from the Radio Gallery of the Senate. The Senate chamber is still empty. They are waiting for the Senate to come back to consider the resolution that I read to you before. You've heard the President speak, and it might be interesting to compare it with the outstanding paragraph of Woodrow Wilson's address to Congress in 1917. As you see, the resolution itself is identical except for the word British and Japanese. And here's what the President Wilson said in 1917, for democracy, for the right of those who submit to authority to have a voice in their own government, for the rights and liberties of small nations, for a universal domination of right by such a concert of free peoples as shall bring peace and safety to all nations and make the world itself at last free. To such a task we can dedicate our lives and our fortunes, everything that we are and everything that we have, with the pride of those who know that the day has come when America is privileged to spend her blood and her might for the principles that gave her birth and happiness and the peace which she has treasured.
By the man behind the man behind the gun.
Our special will continue after these messages.
It's the concert event of the year, Gloria Estefan's Into the Light Tour.
The United Way. It brings out the best in all of us. A public service of the Advertising Council.
The Good Mill Orchestra, Wave 970, and Running Wild. We would like to thank the University of Kentucky and the University of Louisville, which store the Wave 970 archives, and we'll hope you'll join us again next Saturday at 9 o'clock as we continue with a history of Wave.
The following is a special presentation of WAVG Louisville.
Our program last week ended with the American entry into World War II with the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And you'll recall President Roosevelt's speech declaring war on the Empire of Japan. That was December 8, 1941. Today's program begins where Americans were still in shock that December of 1941. Erroneous reports of the damage were being spread by Japan, and the government hadn't fully detailed the damage to our foreign bases. We later learned of the heavy casualty figures at Pearl Harbor. Alone, the American losses were around 2,800 killed during the two-hour attack. 8 battleships were damaged or sunk. Many cruisers and destroyers were hit, and most of the planes at the 6 U.S. air bases were destroyed on the ground. President Roosevelt took the airwaves once again the following day to speak words of comfort and confidence to the United States.
Good evening from the White House in Washington. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, the sudden criminal attacks perpetrated by the Japanese in the Pacific provide the climax of a decade of international immorality. Powerful and resourceful gangsters have banded together to make war upon the whole human race. Their challenge has now been flung at the United States of America. The Japanese have treacherously violated the long-standing peace between us. Many American soldiers and sailors have been killed by enemy action. American ships have been sunk. American airplanes have been destroyed. The Congress and the people of the United States have accepted that challenge. Together with other free peoples, we are now fighting to maintain our right to live among our world neighbors in freedom, in common decency, without fear of assault. I have prepared the full record of our past relations with Japan, and it will be submitted to the Congress. It begins with the visit of Commodore Perry to Japan 88 years ago. It ends with the visit of 2 Japanese emissaries to the Secretary of State last Sunday, an hour after Japanese forces had loosed their bombs and machine guns against our flag, our forces, and our citizens. I can say with utmost confidence that no Americans today or 1,000 years hence need feel anything but pride in our patience and in our efforts through all the years toward achieving a peace in the Pacific which would be fair and honorable to every nation, large or small. And no honest person today or 1,000 years hence will be able to suppress a sense of indignation and horror at the treachery committed by the military dictators of Japan under the very shadow of the flag of peace borne by their special envoys in our midst. The course that Japan has followed for the past 10 years in Asia has paralleled the course of Hitler and Mussolini in Europe and in Africa. Today it has become far more than a parallel. It is collaboration, actual collaboration, so well calculated that all the continents of the world and all the oceans are now considered by the Axis strategists as one gigantic battlefield. In 1931, 10 years ago, Japan invaded Manchukuo without warning. In 1935, Italy invaded Ethiopia without warning. In 1938, Hitler occupied Austria without warning. In 1939, Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia without warning. Later in 39, Hitler invaded Poland without warning. In 1940, Hitler invaded Norway, Denmark, the Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg without warning. In 1940, Italy attacked France and later Greece without warning. And this year, in 1941, the Axis powers attacked Yugoslavia and Greece, and they dominated the Balkans without warning. In 1941 also, Hitler invaded Russia without warning. And now, Japan has attacked Malaya and Thailand and the United States without warning. It is all of one pattern. We are now in this war. We're all in it, all the way. Every single man, woman, and child is a partner in the most tremendous undertaking of our American history. We must share together the bad news and the good news, the defeats and the victories, the changing fortunes of war. So far, the news has been all bad. We have suffered a serious setback in Hawaii. Our forces in the Philippines, which include the brave people of that commonwealth, are taking punishment, but are defending themselves vigorously. The reports from Guam and Wake and Midway Islands are still confused, but we must be prepared for the announcement that all these three outposts have been seized. The casualty lists of these first few days will undoubtedly be large. I deeply feel the anxiety of all of the families of the men in our armed forces and the relatives of people in cities which have been bombed. I can only give them my solemn promise that they will get news just as quickly as possible. This government will put its trust in the stamina of the American people and will give the facts to the public just as soon as two conditions have been fulfilled. First, that the information has been definitely and officially confirmed. And second, that the release of the information at the time it is received will not prove valuable to the enemy, directly or indirectly. Most earnestly, I urge my countrymen to reject all rumors. These ugly little hints of complete disaster fly thick and fast in wartime. They have to be examined and appraised. As an example, I can tell you frankly that until further surveys are made, I have not sufficient information to state the exact damage which has been done to our naval vessels at Pearl Harbor. Admittedly, the damage is serious. But no one can say how serious until we know how much of this damage can be repaired and how quickly the necessary repairs can be made. I cite as another example a statement made on Sunday night that a Japanese carrier had been located and sunk off the canal zone. And when you hear statements that are attributed to what they call an authoritative source, you can be reasonably sure from now on that under these war circumstances, the authoritative source is not any person in authority. Many rumors and reports which we now hear originate, of course, with enemy sources. For instance, today the Japanese are claiming that as a result of their one action against Hawaii, they have gained naval supremacy in the Pacific. This is an old trick of propaganda, which has been used innumerable times by the Nazis. The purposes of such fantastic claims are, of course, to spread fear and confusion among us, and to goad us into revealing military information which our enemies are desperately anxious to obtain. Our government will not be caught in this obvious trap, and neither will the people of the United States. It must be remembered by each and every one of us that our free and rapid communication these days must be greatly restricted in wartime. It is not possible to receive full and speedy and accurate reports from distant areas of combat. This is particularly true when naval operations are concerned. For in these days of the marvels of the radio, it's often impossible for the commanders of various units to report their activities by radio at all, for the very simple reason that this information would become available to the enemy and would disclose their position and their plan of defense or attack. Of necessity, there will be delays in officially confirming or denying reports of operations, But we will not hide facts from the country if we know the facts and if the enemy will not be aided by their disclosure. To all newspapers and radio stations, all those who reach the eyes and ears of the American people, I say this. You have a most grave responsibility to the nation now and for the duration of this war. If you feel that your government is not disclosing enough of the truth, you have every right to say so. But in the absence of all the facts as revealed by official sources, you have no right, in the ethics of patriotism, to deal out unconfirmed reports in such a way as to make people believe that they are gospel truth. Every citizen in every walk of life shares this same responsibility. The lives of our soldiers and sailors, the whole future of this nation, depend upon the manner in which each and every one of us fulfills his obligation to our country. Now a word about the recent past and the future. A year and a half has elapsed since the fall of France, when the whole world first realized the mechanized might which the Axis nations had been building up for so many years. America has used that year and a half to great advantage. Knowing that the attack might reach us in all too short a time, we immediately began greatly to increase our industrial strength and our capacity to meet the demands of modern warfare. Precious months were gained by sending vast quantities of our war material to the nations of the world still able to resist Axis aggression. Our policy rested on the fundamental truth that the defense of any country resisting Hitler or Japan was in the long run the defense of our own country. That policy has been justified. It has given us time, invaluable time, to build our American assembly lines of production. Assembly lines are now in operation. Others are being rushed to completion. A steady stream of tanks and planes, of guns and ships and shells and equipment. That is what these 18 months have given us. But it is all only a beginning of what still has to be done. We must be set to face a long war against crafty and powerful bandits. The attack at Pearl Harbor can be repeated at any one of many points. Points in both oceans and along both our coastlines and against all the rest of the hemisphere. It will not only be a long war, it will be a hard war. That is the basis on which we now lay all our plans. That is the yardstick by which we measure what we shall need and demand. Money, materials, doubled and quadrupled production, ever increasing. The production must be not only for our own Army and Navy and Air Forces, it must reinforce the other armies and navies and air forces, fighting the Nazis and the warlords of Japan throughout the Americas and throughout the world. I have been working today on the subject of production. Your government has decided on two broad policies. The first is to speed up all existing production by working on a seven-day-week basis in every war industry, including the production of essential raw materials. The second policy, now being put into form, is to rush additions to the capacity of production by building more new plants, by adding to old plants, and by using the many smaller plants for war needs. Over the hard road of the past months, we have at times met obstacles and difficulties, divisions and disputes, indifference and callousness. That is now all past, and I am sure forgotten. The fact is that the country now has an organization in Washington built around men and women who are recognized experts in their own fields. I think the country knows that the people who are actually responsible in each and every one of these many fields are pulling together with a teamwork that has never before been excelled. On the road ahead, there lies hard work, grueling work, day and night, every hour and every minute. I was about to add that ahead there lies sacrifice for all of us. But it is not correct to use that word. The United States does not consider it a sacrifice to do all one can. The nation is fighting for its existence and its future life. It is not a sacrifice for any man, old or young, to be in the Army or the Navy of the United States. Rather, is it a privilege. It is not a sacrifice for the industrialist or the wage earner, the farmer or the shopkeeper, the train man or the doctor, to pay more taxes, to buy more bonds, to forego extra profits, to work longer or harder at the task for which he is best fitted. Rather, is it a privilege. It is not a sacrifice to do without many things to which we are accustomed, with the national defense calls for doing without it. A review this morning leads me to the conclusion that at present we shall not have to curtail the normal use of articles of food. There is enough food today for all of us, and enough left over to send to those who are fighting on the same side with us. But there will be a clear and definite shortage of metals for many kinds of civilian use, for the very good reason that in our increased program, we shall need for war purposes more than half of that portion of the principal metals which during the past year have gone into articles for civilian use. Yes, we shall have to give up many things entirely. And I am sure that the people in every part of the nation are prepared in their individual living to win this war. I am sure that they will cheerfully help to pay a large part of its financial cost while it goes on. I am sure they will cheerfully give up those material things that they are asked to give up. And I am sure that they will retain all those great spiritual things without which we cannot win through. I repeat that the United States can accept no result, save victory, final, complete. Not only must the shame of Japanese treachery be wiped out, but the sources of international brutality, wherever they exist, must be absolutely and finally broken. In my message to the Congress yesterday, I said that we will make very certain that this form of treachery shall never endanger us again. In order to achieve that certainty, we must begin the great task that is before us by abandoning once and for all the illusion that we can ever again isolate ourselves from the rest of humanity. In these past few years, and most violently, in the past 3 days, we have learned a terrible lesson. It is our obligation to our dead. It is our sacred obligation to their children and to our children that we must never forget what we have learned. And what we have learned is this. There is no such thing as security for any nation or any individual in a world ruled by the principles of gangsterism. There is no such thing as impregnable defense against powerful aggressors who sneak up in the dark and strike without warning. We have learned that our ocean-girt hemisphere is not immune from severe attack, that we cannot measure our safety in terms of miles on any map anymore. We may acknowledge that our enemies have performed a brilliant feat of deception, perfectly timed and executed with great skill. It was a thoroughly dishonorable deed, But we must face the fact that modern warfare as conducted in the Nazi manner is a dirty business. We don't like it. We didn't want to get in it. But we are in it, and we're going to fight it with everything we've got. I do not think any American has any doubt of our ability to administer proper punishment to the perpetrators of these crimes. Your government knows that for weeks Germany has been telling Japan that if Japan did not attack the United States, Japan would not share in dividing the spoils with Germany when peace came. She was promised by Germany that if she came in, she would receive the complete and perpetual control of the whole of the Pacific area. And that means not only the Far East, but also all of the islands in the Pacific, and also a stranglehold on the west coast of North and Central and South America. We know also that Germany and Japan are conducting their military and naval operations in accordance with a joint plan. That plan considers all peoples and nations which are not helping the Axis powers as common enemies of each and every one of the Axis powers. That is their simple and obvious grand strategy. And that is why the American people must realize that it can be matched only with similar grand strategy. We must realize, for example, the Japanese successes against the United States in the Pacific are helpful to German operations in Libya. That any German success against the Caucasus is inevitably an assistance to Japan in her operations against the Dutch East Indies. That a German attack against Algiers or Morocco opens the way to a German attack against South America and the canal. On the other side of the picture, we must learn also to know that guerrilla warfare against the Germans in, let us say, Serbia or Norway helps us. That a successful Russian offensive against the Germans helps us. And that British successes on land or sea in any part of the world strengthen our hands. Remember always that Germany and Italy, regardless of any formal declaration of war, consider themselves at war with the United States at this moment, just as much as they consider themselves at war with Britain or Russia. And Germany puts all the other republics of the Americas into the same category of enemies. The people of our sister republics of this hemisphere can be honored by that fact. The true goal we seek is far above and beyond the ugly field of battle. When we resort to force, as now we must, we are determined that this force shall be directed toward ultimate good as well as against immediate evil. We Americans are not destroyers. We are builders. We are now in the midst of a war, not for conquest, not for vengeance, but for a world in which this nation and all that this nation represents will be safe for our children. We expect to eliminate the danger from Japan, but it would serve us ill if we accomplished that and found that the rest of the world was dominated by Hitler and Mussolini. So we are going to win the war, and we are going to win the peace that follows. And in the difficult hours of this day, through dark days that may be yet to come, we will know that the vast majority of the members of the human race, all of them, are praying for us. But in representing our cause, We represent theirs as well. Our hope and their hope for liberty under God.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have heard the President of the United States speaking from the White House in Washington.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
This Way's special presentation will continue in a moment.
Hi, this is Tom Perryman of All Points Travel. You know, the time between summer and winter is a good time to travel for two good reasons. It's generally less crowded, and the prices are generally lower. All Points Travel, 454-0888.
On December 11th, 1941, Germany and Italy declared war on the United States. Later that week, nine Latin American countries declared war on the Axis powers. The whole world was at war. By mid-December, Guam and Wake Islands fell. And on December 23, 1941, the Right Honorable Sir Winston Churchill addressed the United States Congress.
The Prime Minister has just come into the floor of the House of the Senate chamber. He is escorted by the members of the committees on the part of the Senate and on the part of the House that have been appointed to escort him into the Senate chamber. He steps now to the clerk's stand. We take you now to...
Members of the Senate and guests of the Senate, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, the Right Honorable Winston Churchill.
Members of the Senate and of the House of Representatives of the United States, I feel greatly honored that you should have invited me to enter the United States Senate chamber and address the representatives of both branches of Congress. The fact that my American forebears have for so many generations played their part in the life of the United States, and that here I am, an Englishman, welcomed in your midst, makes this experience one of the most moving and thrilling in my life, which is already long and has not been entirely uneventful. I wish I wish indeed that my mother, whose memory I cherish across the veil of years, could have been here to see. By the way, I cannot help but reflecting that if my father had been American and my mother British, instead of the other way around, I might have got here on my own. In that case, this would not have been the first time you would have heard my voice. In that case, I should not have needed any invitation. But if I had, it is hardly likely that it would have been unanimous. So perhaps things are better as they are. I may confess, however, that I do not feel quite like a fish out of water in a legislative assembly where English is spoken. I'm a child of the House of Commons. I was brought up in my father's house to believe in democracy. Trust the people. That was his message. I used to see him cheered at meetings and in the streets by crowds of working men way back in those aristocratic Victorian days when, as Disraeli said, the world was for the few and for the very few. Therefore, I have been in full harmony all my life with the tides which have flowed on both sides of the Atlantic against privilege and monopoly, and I have steered confidently towards the Gettysburg ideal of government of the people, by the people, for the people.